Let's go, rock stars. I've opened up a small beta for the Mental Fitness Blueprint, a personalized 90-day guide for working with your mind instead of fighting against it. There's only 50 spots, so if you feel called to this work, I'd love to have you part of that first 50. Details are in the show notes or at mchampagne.com.
Who are you?
I would say father, husband, servant, passionate about expressing love, reflecting love, and bringing people together.
I love that. I love that. Sounds like you've given that some thought.
Not in that succinct fashion.
Sure.
Yeah, for me, that's actually more important than the job titles. I mean, job titles are whatever. You can give yourself any title you want. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, fair. Yeah. It's interesting. So I always ask that question just because, we naturally do default to usually to job titles. And it's always interesting to see how people, especially when people come back on the show as well. And I've had a few of that. It's been three or four times over the duration of the longevity of the show. And you see that who am I question, the core characteristics typically stay the same, but like things evolve and shift, right? Mm-hmm. Which I imagine is similar to you as well. How do you think you would have answered that question as young Tucker, kind of coming in fresh into, as a pilot, I guess you can say, or just about starting your career in that world?
I don't know. I mean, it would have been probably similar, maybe leader. I never actually joined the military to be a pilot. I'm kind of an accidental fighter pilot. I always wanted to serve. And I also, by the way, didn't want to serve in the military. That kind of what started my accidental path to where I am today. I knew I wanted to serve and give back to my community. I didn't know what it was going to look like. And so I knew I wanted, when I got into the military, that I wanted to join it to be a leader, right? Like Saving Private Ryan and Braveheart and Band of Brothers and this idea of like you're serving in the military to lead others. And so I always had that mentality of like I'm actually doing this just to be the best version of myself that I can be, even though it's like deeply flawed. And I always had a mentality of like I'm not here for some title to be a pilot or a fighter pilot or a test pilot. So yeah, I think younger me was somewhat stoic and would have been like, yeah, I'm here to lead.
Did you pick that up? Were you surrounded by that? Like where does that characteristic come from?
Well, when I was young, I was somewhat of a loner for a child, bullied as I was going through like middle school and beginning of high school. But there was something instilled in me very young, and it's kind of a story about my parents, which it was really impactful. So when I was like, I forget exactly, like six, I think it was 6 years old. My mom ended up kind of leaving my dad and moved out of the house and moved away. And it felt like she was kind of leaving us. And so it was a weird time for our family as we were separated. And we'd see her, but not that often. And my dad was taking care of us. And then I remember my mom had a boyfriend and my mom ended up getting pregnant. And she's like she was in her low 40s, like 42, 43 or something. And she was dating this guy who was like 23, 24, somewhere around there, and got pregnant. And he wasn't willing to support her, raise, this kid. And he had his own like relationship, a previous relationship with, I believe, a kid involved with that too. And I remember we were on the East Coast living in Connecticut. And my dad was a successful VP of a restaurant chain out there, Ivy League educated, and doing well. And my mom basically had the courage to say, listen, I need a reset. And my dad had the courage to be like, okay, let's reset together. And so they were apart for years. And then all of a sudden this happens. My mom gets pregnant. She's kind of on her own for a period of time. My dad is like, nope, we're going to do this together. And they up and move with like no notice at all, a couple weeks, all the way out to Colorado. And they're like, we're going to restart together.
Wow. Together.
together. And my dad, like, up and moved from this successful job and was a garbage man, I remember, for like 6+ months, and then a fence pole digger for another 6 months. He couldn't find a job in restaurants. He would tell us, you know, that he would go to restaurants and they would say, you're overqualified. That was the sacrifice that they both made. And that really stuck with me. And then they were firefighters, volunteer firefighters in my small mountain community in Colorado. My mom was a paramedic on top of that. And so I think this idea of service and then like family really was ingrained in me, like at a very small, at a very young age when I was small.
Have you ever, did you and your dad ever talk about that time? Yeah. Like, there's moments in my life too that my dad's he passed about 10 years ago, and now being older, there's moments like that that I would have, like, especially, you know, I'm 41 now, and just love to sit down at the table. Like, when you were going through this, like, what was going through your mind? That's a huge move or a huge decision. Yeah,
it really was. And so I was 8 when we moved back to Colorado, and he moved in the house with me. Or they were together in the same house. We were all together.
Yeah.
But they weren't remarried. They it took about a year, I think, for them to fall back in love with each other. And then they did get remarried to each other. And then they had struggles, as families do. And my dad had struggles. He became addicted to gambling after some failed businesses. And he was in the restaurant. So he started a restaurant and it failed. And he started another restaurant. It was doing well, but his partner was like doing some underhanded things from the restaurant. And so like things didn't always go smoothly. And then he got sick and he got cancer. Mm. And so it was really difficult to watch him go through that and battle that for a couple of years, where he lost the ability to eat. Mm. And then he passed away when I was 21. And because of that, exactly to what you just said, it made me want to capture some lessons learned for my kids, because I couldn't ask him. And I didn't know what to ask him when I'm 20 years old.
Of course, yeah.
Right? And so now I'm like, fast forward a few years, I've lost my dad and I have my own kids, and I start writing down. And that is actually what led me to writing a book, was my desire to be able to share some life perspectives with my children, because I knew that my time with them was not guaranteed.
That's, I mean, it's heartbreaking and beautiful all at the same time is what comes to mind.
Yeah. And my mom is amazing. We have a fantastic relationship. I mean, she's wonderful and courageous and bold. And I hope to be, you know, modeling after her. She like picked up gymnastics when she was in her 50s. And, you know, she's just an adventurer. She went back to college. She just finished a degree and she's almost 80 years old, right? So she's just his afterlife. And I love that. I love that about her, and she's a remarkable woman.
Has she read the book yet?
No, she has not.
Okay.
So, I mean, this is being recorded right before it drops. I didn't have anyone read the book but a couple friends.
Okay.
And I think it was just something I wanted to like put on paper. Once again, I'm not like a author. I mean, I'm an author, but I'm not.
Yeah,
like,
you're going to have to accept that title now.
Yeah. I'm not a good writer, I don't feel. And I just wanted to be able to like give people a final book. My wife and my kids, they didn't read any part of the book. I did let my mom, or I asked her to read. There's a chapter about our life story when I was young, which is pretty vulnerable for her too. I mean, it's her story. And she was all about being able to share it. She's like, listen, I made mistakes. I didn't think I was worthy of being a mom. I thought I was failing at being a mom. So that's why I walked away from the family, you know, and she realizes now that she was always worthy. She was always loved, right? She didn't need to prove anything. And so I know that she is hoping that her lessons learned, her life, if you will, can help others, you know, that are maybe struggling.
Well, I think having advanced access to the book, I think she'll be pretty, pretty proud of her son. So I'm excited that soon she'll be reading the book as well. So I have to ask, so just to get into a little bit of your backstory and fire up some, you've got so many stories that we can pull from, but so then how does one stumble upon being a, not just a pilot, not just a fighter pilot, but a test pilot, like as if all of those other things aren't kind of risky enough careers. So you're going to go full on test pilot in these remarkable, you know, engineering feats and so forth. Like how, and with what you shared around that, it wasn't like you had this big desire to be a pilot. So how does this all come about?
So the pilot thing, I wanted to be an astronaut. And I did know that going into the military wasn't a bad choice. So I joined ROTC at the University of Colorado, like right before school started as a freshman, knowing nothing about military. And I loved it. The people were amazing. I was like, this is a great way for me to serve. I wasn't qualified to fly because I had astigmatism, some depth perception problems. So for years, I never expected to fly at all while I'm in college. And then right before graduating, they came up and they're like, hey, man, all you need to do is wear glasses and you're going to pass this test. Would you like to get some glasses and pass? I was like, oh, sure, I'll give it a try. And so I got glasses. I passed the test. And lo and behold, like I became qualified to become a pilot. And then 2 weeks later, I got picked up because I did well in college. Two weeks later, I got picked up to be a pilot. And I went to pilot training. And this is where it's really tough because it depends on, do you work hard enough to appreciate something, or are you trying to work too hard to force something that shouldn't happen? And I don't know where that line is for people. But for me, I went to pilot training and almost quit numerous times because I thought it was boring. And it was kind of the flying we were doing initially, from flying from point A to point B. And boring is probably too strong of a word, but I would have to commit myself to 10 years of this career. It's a 10-year commitment to be a pilot in the Air Force. Not before you know if you're going to fly fighters or anything, like 10 years.
Yeah.
And this is where like listening to the right voices, I think, really matters. Like discerning a pathway, it depends on, like what are you living for and how are you prepared for certain moments, but really the community that you surround yourself with. And so my wife... and we got married right out of college. We met in ROTC. That's a fun story too. She was the first woman I ever dated or kissed or anything. And there she was. We're almost at 24 years coming up on our marriage. But either way, she was like, I think there's something really powerful here that you're going to like. And she was absolutely right. And so I stuck with it. And then I really fell in love with the combination of the technology. The flying portion was thrilling and fun. The mission. And then the people. So those things really brought it together. And there I was, a pilot, a fighter pilot, because I had really good hand-eye coordination. I mean, some of it just came naturally for me. Played a lot of video games growing up. Maybe that was it. On top of that, I had an engineering degree that I got in college because I was so passionate about trying to, you know, end up in NASA. And so I had... basically the resume to be competitive for test pilot school. But it's a long process. I will tell people, I mean, you have to be a pilot in the Air Force for about 6 years before you're even eligible to become a test pilot. And then it's very competitive. So not only, I mean, I kind of joke around how I like became an accidental fighter pilot and test pilot and stumbled into it a little bit. I mean, don't get me wrong. I work my butt off, right? Like I was working hard, at times for the wrong reasons, but I was working hard. And it all came together where I was very successful academically. I was successful as an officer. I was successful as a pilot. And that's kind of the combination that they're looking for to bring into the test pilot world.
But why the test pilot world for you? Like, what was it?
It was just like being able to interact with the cutting edge technology.
Okay.
And help the warfighter, right? Like if you're a fighter pilot, you're helping national security for sure. Like you're needed to be there for the troops on the ground or for the objectives that the nation has, whatever it may be. And as a test pilot, it's kind of a different level where you're shaping what the future of aviation is going to look like for those warfighters. So the work that I'm doing as a test pilot is actually going to impact like generations after me, not necessarily right then and there. And I loved the ability to be a part of that conversation.
So obviously there's myself and probably most people listening have no idea what it's like or what it feels like to be in the cockpit as a test pilot. Like, can you paint the picture for us?
Yeah.
So not when your landing gear is malfunctioning.
Yeah. Exactly.
We'll get into that story after though.
Not when we're crash landing. A test pilot, and I would say there are kind of two test pilots. One is a developmental test pilot.
Okay.
And they are the first ones to fly an aircraft. So that's a special school we go through. Yeah. So it's called Test Pilot School. It's a year-long school. You get a master's degree while you're there. It's the most intense academic and flying school that is in the world. And yeah. So you go through this year-long experience. Yeah, this is the Chuck Yeagers and the astronauts and all that. And that's what I went through. There is also an operational test pilot, they're called, who are amazing tacticians. And they help in ways that I could never help. And so the combination of these two test pilots, they don't have necessarily a specific school they go to. They're basically experts at the tactics portion.
Okay.
And so we're experts at the technology and almost acquisition aspects. So like how things are acquired in the military. And we're the first ones to fly something. So our job is to make sure that whatever system the government has purchased is safe to fly and meets the contractual specifications that the government set forth with the company in the first place. So yeah, a weapon. We have to make sure that the weapon safely is, you know, carried on the aircraft. We need to make sure that weapon is safely dropped from that aircraft. We need to make sure an additional level that that weapon hits the target that it is supposed to hit. Mm-hmm. A new radar. We need to make sure the radar works the way it's supposed to. A new plane. We need to make sure that the plane takes off and lands and goes to the right airspeeds and pulls the right G-forces. And so you can imagine, like conceptually, it's something new. Someone has to test it. A developmental test pilot is the first one to do that. But it can get very intense because while it's easy to say, oh yeah, we need to make sure the aircraft can pull as many G-forces as the government told the contractor, we want it to be able to pull 9 Gs. Well, the test pilot has to go pull 9 Gs. It gets much more complicated because I need to make sure that I can be, you know, down at 2,000 feet or lower pulling G-forces and doing rolling G-forces. And doing things the plane is typically never going to have to do by a normal pilot flying it. We need to be the ones that go there to make sure that it is safe.
So maybe this question dovetails into the story I'd love for you to share. I was so captivated in the way that you laid it out in the book. But when, like, the whole step-by-step sequence of things not going well, when you realize, well, first of all, you tried to land and the landing gear was not down and kind of pulled it right up right away. And then, you know, you're in the, you're what'd you call it? Like the back seat. Like there's a whole bunch of the, like 5 minutes of fuel left. There's just so many things going on. So I guess this two-part question is just A, can you just kind of walk us through that story or that circumstance? And then what I'm really interested in, like since this is a mental fitness podcast, how do you keep the mind, you know, in check so that you can actually do what you need to do? In this case, of course, to stay alive. Yeah. But then I mean, imagine many of these scenarios just to be level-headed and actually pull through.
Absolutely. I will tell you, being a fighter pilot and then additionally a test pilot, you basically are always feeling like you're in life and death situations because things are happening very fast. And so it's a very unforgiving environment, which means we need to be very exact with how we maneuver. We need to have a knowledge base that is very strong that we can rely upon. And we need a community that is there to help us when we're in difficult situations as well, because I may land an aircraft, but it's usually several things that go into making that possible. So in the story that you're referring to, I was in an F-15D. So an F-15C is what I originally started flying. It's two-engine, two-tail fighter aircraft that was meant for air-to-air flying. So air-to-air means I am just carrying missiles, and I am just there to shoot down or protect against other aircraft that the adversary may have. So it's just air-to-air. I don't have any bombs or anything like that. The F-15C is that. It's a single seat. The F-15D is a two-seat of the same exact aircraft. The second seat, it's really just meant for training. So when a pilot is learning to land, for instance, they'd have an instructor in the back seat. The student pilot would be in the front seat, and they would learn how to land with a pilot there just as kind of a safety. And then once they got good enough, they would that pilot would just be cleared to go fly the F-15C.
Yeah, makes sense.
And with like air refueling, you usually have an instructor in the backseat to teach you how to do that, especially initially. So we had a F-15D that was a test aircraft too, where the pilot would fly in the front seat, and then we'd put a test engineer in the backseat to collect data on certain missions. Well, this mission, I was in the backseat as the instructor, and in the front seat was a helicopter test pilot. We were just giving them a familiarization ride, so they got an experience of like what it's like to be flying this fighter. And so he sits in the front seat.
Gosh.
And so we take off, and he's has about 2 hours of academics beforehand, and he's in the front seat, so he has almost all the controls. In the back seat, I can control the flight controls. I have a flight control stick. I have engines, so the throttles, but I can't turn the engines off. I can just do minimal things with that. And then I have the gear handle and basically nothing else. There's very little in the back seat. And so we go with another F-15 to go do some training and teach him in the front seat, right? Like, hey, this is flying a fighter aircraft, and we're going to go supersonic, and we're going to pull some G-forces and have this experience. Use a heads-up display. You know, he has as a front seat pilot, he has a heads-up display in front of him, and just, you know, get that feel. We rejoin on our wingman at the end of this mission, and our wingman's missing one of his tails. So we're like, hey, man, over radio. I was like, hey, just so you know, everything is fine, I think, but you're missing one of your tails. And then he comes back over, he's like, oh, yeah, I see that now. Thank you. Okay, you know. I forget his call sign we were using that day, but he's like, okay, I'm an emergency aircraft now. I'm missing a tail. And when you declare an emergency, that means you have priority, and like the fire trucks come out and they're going to be ready to like help you. And so we join on this wingman of ours as he comes in and lands, and he configures for landing, and we're chasing him just as like a safety. And we put our gear down to chase him, and he lands safely. No problem. It has two tails. We're fine. Just one of them was gone. Just part of one of them.
Yeah.
He lands. And so we're basically out of fuel at this point. We need to come in and land. It's not an emergency, but we need to land. We're low on fuel. So we bring the gear handle up to go do one pattern to land, and the front seat pilot's going to land. We bring the gear up, but the gear does not come up safely. And there's lights in the cockpit that tell us like, hey, the gear is not where it needs to be. And it's like, oh, that's not good. Let's put the gear back down. Mm-hmm. And then we get all the indications that the gear is totally down and safe. And we're like, all right, good. We're totally fine. If the gear is down, we call it down and locked. Down and locked, and we have three green gear indications, meaning like we are totally good. It is safe to land. So I'm like, all right, front seat pilot, Derek was his name. He's amazing. And you have the aircraft. You're going to be able to land. So let's pull back around and land. And he comes down and touches down, and we're going to like stop the aircraft, but to be done for the mission. But he touches down, and there's like a weird feeling that is very abnormal for me, anyone that's used to landing these aircraft, where it feels like the aircraft is starting to like dip off to the side. So I immediately plug it into five stages of afterburner. That's basically all full forward, as fast as we could go, as much power as we could get, and then immediately take us back off. So I take control of the aircraft, and we take back off. And I'm like, I don't know what that was. Like, that is super weird. It was uncomfortable. But I don't know what's going on. And so I asked the tower, like, did you guys see anything? And they're like, yeah, it looked like you may have blown a tire, which happens. And we're like, all right, that could have happened. That's weird. Do you have another aircraft that can meet up with us and tell us what's going on? So at this point, they're like, no, there's an aircraft 100 miles away. I'm like, all right, well, I don't have much time for fuel. So now my heart's kind of racing. I'm like, okay, what are we going to do? And we basically then start talking to the wingman that had just landed. We start talking to him, and we're like, dude, did you see anything? He's like, no, your gear looks good, man. I don't know. Let me get into the checklist. And so he opens his checklist from the ground and starts telling us, you know, different steps of what this possibly could be. We fly around. I sometimes have one, a really thick checklist that is meant for emergencies. You kind of flip to different pages. And so we're like running low on fuel, you know, 2 minutes goes by, 3 minutes goes by. I'm like, I got to get this bird on the ground or we're going to have a real issue. And then we decide, well, we have to take the cable. There's a cable that we have on runways that we can catch in an emergency. So we have a hook at the back of our plane. So we lower the hook and we're like, all right, we're going to catch this cable. And then
this is right similar to like the aircraft carriers, similar
to aircraft carriers. We don't do it on aircraft carriers because our landing gear is not strong enough to take that force of that type of stopping.
Sure.
But it's still a cable that we're going to catch.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I don't know what was wrong, but we're going to catch this cable. And then we get on a final, which means like 5 miles from landing, and we're going, you know, 200 miles an hour. So things happen very fast. And then finally, that aircraft that was 100 miles away, they booked it and got back on our wing, rejoined on us, and was like, no, your gear's good, man.
and our gear's indicating good still. He's like, no, your gear's totally fine. So there I was, 5 miles from landing, in the back seat having to fly it. The front seat pilot is a helicopter pilot, so he's an amazing pilot, but he's not used to flying forward.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah. Well, hovering. And in this scenario too. Yeah. He's like, get me back my chopper.
Yeah, exactly. And then I can't see anything. I'm in the back seat. So it's hard to convey. Like, I have no visibility in front of me. I see his head, his helmet, the cockpit. So I can basically see, if you think of a clock, like 12 o'clock is straight in front of you. 6 o'clock is straight behind you. I basically can only see from like 2:30 to 10:30 or so, somewhere in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I can't see the runway. Like, I literally cannot see the runway. So I'm flying, and then they're like, all right, we don't know what's wrong, but you have to catch this cable, which means you have to land in a 400-foot landing zone that is basically you can't touch down too early, or you'll hit an underrun area, which is bad. You can't touch down too late, or you'll miss the cable that's strung out. So you have about a 400-foot landing zone. You're going 200 miles an hour. So it's like less than a second that you have to like actually get the plane in the right spot. And so he's like helping me. I'm telling him, hey, tell me where my lift vector is. That's kind of where we're pointed on the runway. He used my eyes in that situation. I'm trying to talk to the chase aircraft, and the fuel, like low light is coming on. So now we're out of gas, and we touch down, and our aircraft like falls to the left as our wing goes into the runway. And then we skip the wing, skips over the cable, thank goodness. The hook catches the cable as we're starting to veer off to the side of the runway. And we come to a stop. Well, it turns out that there's extremely, extremely rare situation where the gear indicates it's totally safe, but it is not. And the gear had collapsed. So when we touched down, the left main landing gear collapsed up into the aircraft.
Just went back up. Oh.
And we were going off to the side. So a few things for people to be made aware of, like this has happened around 5 times. And 3 of the times those aircraft go off the runway and will like cartwheel and you have to eject basically. On top of that, when we first touched down and we didn't know there was something wrong and we kind of dipped to the side, I had about a 0.5 second reaction time to be able to take it off again before it dug too much and we go off to the side somewhere around there. So basically it was a very high pressure, tense situation for the, 10 minutes or however long it was that we were dealing with this emergency.
Well, and how do you, you land and you realize obviously, the plane's turning, obviously that's not normal. So, but like, how do you make the decision to, can you even eject from that, like when you're on the ground like that? I guess
Yes, if we're prepared. Okay. But that's why I'm saying, like, we have this mentality of, well, trying to always be prepared for the worst.
Okay.
But that kind of, that goes back to your other question, which is like, how do you, I don't want to say and be too dramatic, but like, how do you live this life of like high pressure, high consequence?
Yeah.
You know, decision making, like where's your intuition? How are you prepared? How have you practiced? How do you have the right people around you to make sure that you're always trying to become better and that you're always ready? And yeah, it's an intense profession that starts very young in pilot training with like preparing us for the unknown. So not even test pilots, just like pilots.
Yeah.
We'll go through emergency procedures all the time. We'll talk through emergency procedures. Like an instructor will say, okay, you're at 20,000 feet. It's a beautiful day. You have an airfield 10 miles off your nose and you look off to your left wing and you see a liquid. You have the aircraft and you're like, all right, it's like role playing, like Dungeons and Dragons style. And you're like, all right, I have the aircraft. You know, I look down at my fuel gauge. Does my fuel gauge show that it's like decreasing? Yes, it does. All right. I'm assuming initially I have a fuel leak. I'm going to declare an emergency. And so you go through all the steps and processes and you do that often so that we're always seeing every situation through a lens of like, I've practiced this before. It's an emergency situation and this is what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah.
So that's a part of it. I think another part is just trying to be present and not complacent. Like in life, I feel we find ourselves very complacent with our day to day. And it's a shame because I think there's so many opportunities for us to excel or to be fulfilled by just like trying to be there and not like just go through the motions, but to be engaged with that person or listening intently to maybe it's a podcast and really absorbing that, or maybe it's thinking through in silence the meeting that you have coming up, or you see what I'm saying? Like, being like totally present is going to be, I think, in that situation, what helped save us when I knew to go around. But that also depends on other things, like how much rest did I have the night before? Like, how clear was my mind going into that? And those are really important factors to being able to perform at the highest level, is like being prepared mentally and physically and socially and spiritually.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is where, I mean, obviously it dovetails really well into the book in the last 20%, because I'm biased, of course, because of this kind of work. But I think that last 20% is like what you're saying. There's a huge component around making sure that our minds are healthy and able to, so that we're able to actually perform under these extreme situations. I mean, not everyone's in a plane going through that kind of an emergency situation, but there's a lot of things going on in life all the time. And I think they kind of stack up and so forth. Right. Like, and that's where it gets, it's not just like there's a survival mode situation that obviously saved you in that pilot, but then there's also just being able to handle life's pressures and so forth and whatnot. Right. It's wild.
Yeah. Well, and I think it also has something to do about being disciplined with how we live our lives. And that has something to do with our purpose and what we're living for. Like, I think it's all tied together. That is kind of the premise of my book. The stories are exciting and fun because, I've had a really cool opportunities and there's some cool things that have happened in me and other people's lives that I know about that I am able to share in the book. The leadership aspect of the book, the self-help aspect of the book, it's not revolutionary, right? I think ultimately it's about a holistic approach to becoming a better version of ourselves, which means like living intentionally for a purpose and living out our priorities and trying to be balanced and being disciplined and being prepared and then being resilient because everything is going to go wrong, right? Mm-hmm. Like at some level, and then like leaning on our community and then also like using technology effectively and thinking about our legacy. Like that is it's like this holistic approach, which I think is really what it takes for us to be successful. And even more important, as we are adopting artificial intelligence, I think there's some real important lessons for us to take away with, like if we want to like succeed with the adoption of this transformative technology, I think we need to be really well grounded in what makes us human.
Oh, yep.
And focused on like being that person, right? Like being the person of character that has virtue that is distinctly different than the machine so that we can best use the machine to optimize our performance even more.
So true. So interesting. So I've been having conversations using AI with ancient teachers and really interesting figures of the past, like Einstein and Rumi and Carl Jung and so forth. And I did a series, or because it's just, I was curious. I'm like, I was asking them, I mean, if you were living in our day today with all everything that we have access to and everything that's going on in the world when it comes to technology and AI, I mean, what questions would you be asking? And all of them in some way came back to what you just said around, this stuff is great, but don't forget about humanity. I think that, and that starts with us understanding, you know, what it is for us to be human and to ask the questions and so forth. And Einstein came back too, and he said, you know, he obviously talked about the atomic bomb and so forth, and how he had some regrets initially around signing the papers that allowed that to happen. But then he spent the rest of his life on committees, making sure that, you know, there were good groups of people to make, you know, to have the conversations that needed to be had to make sure the world was safe right across the board. And he kept coming back to this, again, asking those questions and the humanity part And I found that really interesting.
Yeah, that's really fascinating to be able to use the technology in that way. I mean, I would caution any listener to be mindful of like a system and what you're using and how biased it could be. And that's not the real voice of those people, but it's really, I'm not trying to take away from anything.
Yeah, you just said.
It's good. I get concerned that we will slowly hand over human autonomy, human agency, human decision-making, almost like human intelligence, because in the sense of like, we will become less intelligent. We will not challenge ourselves enough. We will not be filled with passion and grit and that fire inside of us that makes us want to pursue like amazing, remarkable things, which could be like changing the world in such a way or pursuing technology in such a way or impacting people in such a way that we kind of abdicate our responsibility to be human. Yeah. And that does concern me.
So how are you, because just knowing some of the work that you're doing now around, I mean, aviation, AI, defense, technology, and so forth, you've got diverse, but they all kind of converge in a way when it comes to technology, of course, but a diverse kind of set of projects, I guess, and initiatives around. And I think last time I chatted with you, you were just back from some sort of delegation meeting with, was it China and the US and AI ethics and so forth. So I guess how personally, like how are you handling this? Or how, like, what are some of the, if I was in your journal and your mind, think like what questions and what things are you thinking about to try to balance, I guess, the time that we're in right now?
Yeah. Well, I want to be engaged with the challenges that we're facing as a society and as a race. So I want to be informed and I want to bring to those conversations, I want to be a part of the conversations, and I want to bring to those conversations a perspective that is unemotional and advocating for character and virtue. Like, I don't think you'll go wrong in, you know, with that type of approach.
Yeah.
And I think the conversations are as easy enough as like starting them with your own circle, your own family, your own friends, your community. And I think that anyone could and should be engaged to that level to try to challenge us to be better. And we have lots of problems as a nation, as a world. I mean, we're seeing it unfold right now in many ways, not just with like a war with Iran that is ongoing while we're recording this. But, you know, the list is innumerable, it seems.
Yeah.
And so I think it is just knowing that we have a responsibility to be engaged, knowing that we should be trying to become better versions of ourselves, and being engaged, you know, with our own like individual growth as well as, you know, the people around us and being there for them. And I find that what I want to do is bring about the conversation, right? So I host a Fighter Pilot podcast. I just started hosting Duties a couple months ago, but I want to talk about the future of aviation and autonomy and AI. And I want people to be considering, what does it mean to have an autonomous drone flying around? Should we? I mean, maybe. Should we not? Well, maybe. I don't know. Like, it's up for debate, and that debate needs to happen between us and not just the tech execs, billionaire, you know, political class, which is important for them to have those discussions too. But I think it's for all of us to take some responsibility. And so I'm just trying to further our progress through these conversations and just bringing it up in meaningful ways that are also trying not to be too preachy or too close-minded or too like, well, this is the opinion that I have and I'm not going to change it, but like open-minded, right? Like, we can all learn from what's going on and we should be trying to work together. And that collaboration piece is part of the community piece, but that I fear we're moving away from because technology is making it easier for us to silo one another off, right? From cancel culture all the way to, you know, our Facebook feeds, all the way to even, I think, some limitations that government or other people are, you know, trying to bring their own biases to it. And there is a balance. Like, I don't want hate speech everywhere on like, I don't want a large language model that is like just spewing hate. So there's some freedoms we need to protect on the other end of that, though. Like, people need to be able to express themselves. And so, right, like all of those things, it's very complicated. I think we just need to talk about it, but we need to try to deliberately
focus on bringing in other perspectives and talking to other people about it, because they're not wrong, right? I'm not right though. Yeah. And so like, that's the mentality, like I may not be right and they may not be wrong. So how about we discuss?
Well, and just have open, like you said, you know, open dialogue without a bunch of emotion behind everything. And again, ironically, through these conversations, these interviews, I guess, that I was having with these ancient teachers, this also came up around back in like their day of bringing, you know, you have an engineer and a poet and a politician. Like it's not just all, you know, politicians or all pilots. Like, let's all come together because people have different disciplines, different perspectives and so forth. And again, have a collective, like nice open conversation with, you know, various backgrounds and so forth. Yeah. And I think we're stronger by doing that. Have there been any big perspective shifts that have come from the conversations you've been having that even for you personally, you're like, oh, that's interesting. I never, you know, I mean, pick a topic, but I never would have thought about it like that.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, it started for me, I think I was kind of wired this way to a certain extent. Like, I've always been curious of what other people thought. And I think some of that was a desire to be liked and to gain people's approval. And that drove me to wanting to be amenable to their perspective. And and that, I think, actually was a good foundation for me to really understand empathy more effectively, which then brought me, I think, some high emotional intelligence. And so I'm able to like connect with people and try not to judge too much. And there's some faith aspect of that too, where then I understand like the beauty of people's sacrifice is really awesome, amazing, as you think about like what people have done to, you know, sacrifice for generations after them. And then also like grace, and what does it mean to receive grace? And what does it mean to give grace to ourselves and to others? And all of this, I think, turns into a mindset of like, I want to learn from other people. I think that we have a lot more in common than uncommon, and definitely more in common that society is telling us. Society is almost wanting us to fight, it seems. But when I was in Afghanistan, it was very eye-opening because I'm a special, it's called an MC-12, intelligence gathering plane. And we're the eyes and the ears of special operators. So we're a few thousand feet above like what's going on. But, you know, man, it's intense work. And we're watching terrorists. I mean, are they definitely were bad guys.
Yeah.
And I have no sympathy for the way they were treating, you know, their families or their society, and like murdering people and trying to terrorize people. And like, if you don't agree with me, and we're seeing it play out in that society still, I think, in Afghanistan, which is a shame. Oh, but you also see a humanity to them. And that's like, that's important for us to not lose sight. Like, I disagree with them. I have different values than them. Some of that's just because I'm biased and because they're biased too. And they were imbued those values from their culture, right? Mm-hmm. I think we could argue that some of us, if put in that same situation, would have been doing the same thing that they're doing, right? Yeah. Which connects us to a certain extent. Now, I disagree with them and I was proud to do the work we were doing, but they were still humans, and you'd see them come home and, you know, their kids would run up to them, you know, as their kids were playing in the compound area, and their spouses would come up to them, and they're human, right? And
it's so, not binary. It's like, it's complex.
Yeah, exactly. And then for me, I think, I don't know about perspective, like there was a light switch that went on, but I will tell you, when I learned about AI, I was the director of the MIT AI Accelerator. So it was a dedicated AI unit, the first dedicated AI unit for the Air Force. And we were helping shape MIT research, all for the common good. There was nothing military about it, but it was things that we could work together with them on in delivering for society, which would also help, you know, Air Force equities. And I learned about AI more in depth in that role. And it really made me more concerned than I had ever been before about our national security, not just because of the threat that we are facing because of our adversaries with AI, but because of the power of the tool and how it was going to impact society writ large. So that was like, that just was a transformative, like, oh my goodness, I didn't realize that this was going to be such a monumental shift for.
What was it about that there? What was the insight that you, I mean, obviously whatever you can share, but that made the difference. I think we're starting to see that as a general population, but even that, we're just scratching the surface of what this, it's not just a chat bot, you know, it's not just chat GPT.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And it was obvious to a certain extent before ChatGPT came out, like we knew large language models were going to be completely revolutionary. And ChatGPT comes out and guess what? It's like completely revolutionary. But we knew that, you know, years before it came out, and we kept trying to tell people like, no, this is going to be a big deal. We need to start adjusting for it. And so now AI and large language model, like I think is cute. I think AI being expressed through physical autonomous systems is what is really going to drive change. In ways that could be really good, but also really bad. And I think it was that. A large language model, cool, but what about an army of, you know, AI-powered robots?
Yeah.
And we're seeing robots coming out, and they're going to be a part of our society, whether we like it or not. I'm probably more of an optimist and think they could be applied in many cool, fascinating, helpful ways. But with that cool, helpful, fascinating comes, like, scary, detrimental, risky. And so how do we make sure that we mitigate that negative aspect while we support the positive?
Yeah.
But I think it was just warfare being done by drones. This was before Ukraine and Russia happened, was my concern that we're going to take humanity out of warfare. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be extremely detrimental to the entire world.
Well, that's where my mind was going when you were explaining this, is that humanity part again, and even the, you know, what you described and what you were seeing flying, you know, thousands of miles above, you know, Afghanistan, and like you see, like, that's the human part. And it's not just, I mean, of course, you know, in a military scenario, there's that obviously, but like right across the board, I mean, like, we can't forget about the humanity part. It's not just dollars and cents. It's not just efficiencies. It's like, right? Like, that's where I think, like, this stuff is here. I mean, it's not like we can stop that, but I think we can still take pauses to ask some questions as humans, right?
100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pauses. Yeah. And that could have a negative connotation when people be like, well, we can't stop studying AI. And, you know, you get the open AI and the Anthropic and other people having that like argument about, oh, we can't. And I do think it's hard to stop, because I don't think we trust other people enough to know that they would stop if we were to stop.
Yeah.
And so there's,
I mean, to pause though, just literally to have a conversation.
That, yes. Like, we need to be able to say, okay, what is this going to look like? How is this going to affect society? How are we going to watch out for people as they're losing jobs left and right? And I think it is going to be a job destroyer. I think it's also going to be a job creator, but we need to be mindful and thoughtful of that. And we should be learning from our history, and we should be having the discussions in our politics and in our society. And I fear we're not, because we're so consumed right now with just like being angry with the other side that we're not understanding that there's real value in that pause, and in that.
Yeah. Well, it makes me think of what you shared about your training as a pilot, right? Like how you role play and go through as many situations as you can. And that ultimately is what prepares you for when you're in those situations. And even the example you shared, I mean, I think you said that's only happened 5 times. So, you know, maybe you didn't even go through that scenario, but you've gone through enough of that thinking to prep your mind and your nervous system for being in a state like that, where, like, imagine you didn't do any of that kind of stuff. It's not even, you can't even imagine that, but that's kind of, in a way, sort of what we're doing with this technology, because it's going so fast.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? It's like we've basically covered our own eyes and we're groping in the dark when it's not really dark outside.
Yeah.
All we need to do is open our eyes. But I fear that we've also set up systems that don't incentivize those conversations.
Sure.
They don't incentivize our political system to, you know, be collaborative in nature. Our system is right now set up to basically polarize, and that is not what we need at this moment of our human history. We need to come together. But, you know, how do you say that? You can express it yourself.
Yeah.
But how do you convince other people? Whole other ball game. Very difficult.
Totally. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think here's my take on that. Last question for you, because I know we're at time. But I feel like if I were to pull this all full circle, like this is also where your book plays a role. I mean, I think, and you mentioned this already, but I mean, if we focus on that last 20% and we focus on us individually as well and equipping our minds and equipping ourselves with what it takes to be at our best, naturally we start to ask better questions, right? And we start to see what other people maybe not seeing that are operating in survival mode and super stressed. Because I see this across teams around the world. I mean, most people are max stressed. Like you're just trying to get to the end of the day. Yeah. So we like really hard to think about other people when you're in that state, right? So if we can get people out of that, and I think your book helps a lot on that mission, then we can get to a place where, okay, it's like you kind of zoom out into clean air in a way, right? And like, okay, here's what's going on. And the more we do that individually, then it's, you know, I don't know about you, but I like to be around people where it feels like it's, they're a little bit more calm and grounded versus someone completely stressed and scattered. And I think that's how we can kind of move as a tribe in a way.
I completely agree. I think that's very insightful. Absolutely.
Yeah. How do you want people to feel after they put down your book? And I guess what's any parting words for us?
Yeah, you know, I'd say a few things. I want people to think about who they're becoming. Are they becoming the person that they were meant to become? And only they can answer that. And it's not just professional. It is not professional. It is, your title is not your profession. You know, as a leader, as a parent, as a friend, as a brother, sister, whatever it may be, I think titles and achievements can distract us from the deeper question of who we're actually becoming through the journey, the process. So who are you becoming? I want people to like reflect on that. And I also want them to think about, am I living in alignment with what matters most, with my priorities? We often will spout out priorities, but we don't live those priorities. I think it's easy to declare our values, but it's much harder to live them out consistently. And so I think people need to step back and ask whether like their time and their energy, their attention are really reflecting the priorities that they want to hold true to.
So,
and then I also would say, they need to realize, I believe in my heart, and if they were to reflect too, they have more to give, because I think we all have more to give. And that is a question that I want them to think about. Do they have more to give? So, you know, it kind of sits at the heart of my book. And I think most of us comfortably operate at 80%, even though we're stressed and other things, or we're competent and whatever. But I still think we're holding something back. And that holding something back, I think, is a holistic approach to how we're dealing with life and relying on our community, but also being disciplined and also being purpose-filled and being prepared, being resilient and focused on our legacy. So I would leave listeners with those thoughts, like who are they becoming and how are they living in alignment with their priorities, and how are they basically internalizing and appreciating and then living out this idea that they have more to give.
I mean, I can't think of a better way. It's a beautiful wrap. And if everyone asked those questions, I think that we'd be in a very different place with everything we just talked about when it comes to technology and so forth. Because it's right, like you can't be real truthful and honest with those questions and not then question other things that seem to be off. Like there's a gap, there's a disconnect, right? And to your point though, I think a lot of people, they're operating at 80, there's the 80%. And I think the 80% in my mind is almost like the autopilot. And if we don't come, when we're on autopilot, we don't really ask questions. We kind of just go, we roll and we flow, which is okay in short periods of time, but not, definitely not in times that we're in right now or in a longer duration. And that's that I think that's that extra 20%.
Yeah.
And we all win. So,
yeah.
Tucker, I mean, there's a million things I wanted to ask you about, but we're out of time and I want to respect your time. And I think, you know, we covered off some pretty big topics and I deeply appreciate you coming on the show. And then of course, just what you're doing in the world. It means a lot. And I'm really grateful that there are people like you out there doing this kind of work. So thank you.
Yeah, Mark, thank you. It's always a pleasure. And I think these conversations are really important and valuable for people to reflect on, because the time demands it, what we're facing right now. And it requires all of us, right? This is something that we're only going to be able to tackle together. So I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to share my perspectives.